Good morning. President Trump wants more immigration enforcement. He also wants more investments from other countries. After an immigration raid in a Hyundai plant, will the world keep spending here? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Russia's latest attacks make it through Ukraine's defenses, setting a key government building on fire. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The U.S. is considering more sanctions against countries that buy Russian oil. Have past rounds worked? Also, after President Trump fired the last Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner over a jobs report he didn't like, can the latest numbers be trusted? It's Monday, September 8th. On this day in 1966, audiences saw Captain Kirk and his crew's adventures in space, The Final Frontier, for the first time as Star Trek premiered. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he thinks Israel and Hamas will reach a deal over Gaza soon. NPR's Luke Garrett reports Trump said earlier this is the final warning for Hamas.
President Trump said Israel has accepted terms on a Gaza deal, but did not provide details. In a Sunday afternoon social media post, Trump urged Hamas to accept this deal and release the hostages, saying this is his, quote, last warning. The president posted this while attending the U.S. Open Men's Championship. Trump spoke to reporters after flying back to Joint Base Andrews near Washington, D.C. The president says he had, quote, good discussions while on Air Force One.
I think we're going to have a deal on Gaza very soon.
Trump did not give details on the Gaza deal, but he did say he thinks the remaining Israeli hostages and bodies will be returned. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli authorities say gunmen have killed at least five people in Jerusalem today. Hamas has praised the attack. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, the shooting comes as Israel is considering a U.S. proposal for a Gaza ceasefire.
Israeli police say two gunmen opened fire toward a bus stop at a major intersection in northern Jerusalem, leading to Jewish settlements in the East Jerusalem area. They say a security officer and civilian shot the gunmen. The Israeli military said the gunmen were Palestinian. Israeli emergency services said a woman and several men were killed in the attack, and others were seriously wounded from gunshots. No group immediately took responsibility, but Hamas commended the attack and said Israel's plans to occupy Gaza City would not go unpunished. Before the attack, Israel said it was seriously considering President Trump's new offer for a Gaza ceasefire. Hamas said it's ready to negotiate. Daniel Estrin, NPR News. Tel Aviv.
President Trump is scheduled to deliver remarks to the White House Religious Liberty Commission today. That meeting will be held in Washington, D.C. at the Museum of the Bible. South Korean officials say they've reached a deal for the release of more than 300 people. They were detained in a U.S. immigration raid last week at a Hyundai electric vehicle battery plant in southern Georgia. The facility is one of several major South Korean investments in that state. From member station WABE, Molly Samuel has more.
The plant is a joint venture between Korean companies Hyundai Motor Group and LG Energy Solution. It's under construction near a Hyundai EV and hybrid car factory that began production last year. Georgia has long-running business ties to South Korea, and the state maintains an office in Seoul. 475 people were detained in the raid, most of them South Korean nationals. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the months-long investigation is the biggest in agency history. A South Korean official said they plan to push to review visa policies, and the country is chartering a plane to bring the Korean workers home. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Trump says he does not want to go to war in American cities. This remark comes after he posted an image online of himself over the weekend sitting in front of a picture of the Chicago skyline with flames and helicopters. He wrote Chicago was about to find out why it's called the Department of War. That's his alternate name for the Department of Defense. Trump now says his administration will clean up cities, not go to war. Carlos Alcaraz is the winner of the U.S. Open men's tennis tournament. The 22-year-old Spaniard now has six tennis Grand Slam titles to his name. And with this win, he reclaims the world number one ranking. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Alcaraz was on fire at the U.S. Open this year. He didn't drop a single set on his way to the men's singles final. There, he met, who else, Jannik Sinner, the 24-year-old Italian with whom Alcaraz has taken over the world of men's tennis. In Queens on Sunday, Alcaraz finally lost a set, but only one, ultimately beating Sinner in four sets, 6-2, 3-6, 6-1, 6-4. Between them, Alcaraz and Sinner have won every Grand Slam title this year and last. Before accepting his trophy, Alcaraz first thanked his rival.
I'm seeing you more than my family, so it's Jesus. So it's, it's great to share the courts.
The next Grand Slam isn't until January. That'll be the Australian Open. That's the only Grand Slam title Alcaraz has not yet won in his career. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Forecasters say Hurricane Kiko will sweep north of the Hawaiian Islands tomorrow and Wednesday. Top sustained winds are at 100 miles per hour, but Kiko's winds are weakening. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale. Concluding the story of the Crawley family, this motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
If you're familiar with Minnesota cuisine other than hot dish, you know about wild rice. Restaurants all over the land of 10,000 Lakes feature wild rice soup, pancakes, porridge, sausage, and other delicacies that use this famous grain. But did you know it's not rice? It's actually a watergrass seed called Zizania aquatica. It grows naturally in cold rivers and lakes, like the ones so plentiful in Minnesota. Called manumen by the Anishinaabe, wild rice is still harvested in the traditional way. Paddling a canoe through water where the wild rice grows, they use sticks to beat the seeds onto the bottom of the boat. Myron Burns, an Anishinaabe elder from Bad River, says manumen plays a role in his culture's creation story.
Wild rice, that's our livelihood. That's why we're located here. We migrated from out east, and they said that the food grows on the water. That's where you'll settle.
Recently, a group of concerned environmentalists and Ojibwe activists launched a grassroots effort called Protect Our Manumen. They maintain that sulfide mining and genetic engineering harms the wild rice. This, they say, endangers something uniquely Minnesotan.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And Mae Martinez in Culver City, California. The man accused of attempting to assassinate Donald Trump last year will represent himself in his jury trial. That starts today. We'll hear more about his defense in just a few minutes. First, though, South Korean officials say they've negotiated for the release of more than 300 people who were detained during an immigration raid last week at an electric vehicle battery facility near Savannah, Georgia. The Korean workers account for a majority of those detained in what the Department of Homeland Security said was its largest ever single-site investigation. From member station WABE in Atlanta, here's Molly Samuel.
The raid happened at a battery factory under construction at a huge industrial manufacturing site. The anchor of that site is a new Hyundai electric and hybrid vehicle plant. Cars started rolling off the line there last year. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp announced plans for that Hyundai factory back in 2022.
It is my great honor to officially announce that Hyundai Motor Group will build their first dedicated electric vehicle manufacturing plant right here in this good soil in Bryan County.
Kemp touted the billions of dollars of investment it would bring, including from suppliers, and the thousands of jobs that would be created.
Welcoming the largest economic development project in our state's history. Congratulations again.
Georgia has pushed to become a center of solar panel, electric vehicle, and battery manufacturing. The state also has close business ties to South Korea. Governor Kemp has visited multiple times, and the state has an economic development office in Seoul. Those efforts have paid off with big announcements like the Hyundai factory, which have brought in other companies and projects like this battery plant that was raided last week. Next door to the car factory, it's a joint venture between Hyundai Motor Group and LG Energy Solution, slated to start production early next year. Last Thursday, 475 workers at the site were detained and taken to an immigration detention center in South Georgia.
This was not a immigration operation where agents went into the premises, rounded up folks, and put them on buses.
At a press conference the next day, Stephen Schrenk with the Department of Homeland Security said some of the detainees were in the U.S. illegally, others had overstayed their visas or were using the wrong visa to work.
This has been a multi-month criminal investigation where we have developed evidence, conducted interviews, gathered documents, and presented that evidence to the court in order to obtain a judicial search warrant.
Schrenk said the workers were employed by contractors, subcontractors, sub-subcontractors. He said investigators were still untangling who was employed where. In a statement last week, Hyundai said, based on what it called its current understanding, none of those detained worked directly for the motor company. A South Korean official said the country was chartering a plane to bring the workers back to Korea and said the country would work to review and improve visa systems for people working in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
For more on this, we're joined by Tammy Overby, an international business consultant. She formerly led the U.S.-Korea Business Council at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. She was also president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Korea. Good morning, Tammy. Thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure.
So why do you think this raid happened at the construction site of a U.S. Hyundai plant, and why now?
I think because it's a major in construction project, probably one of the largest going on. South Korean investors are among the largest in the U.S. right now, and there are lots of people there. And I think why now? We understand this reveals the tension between the Trump administration's desire to bring make things in America, bring these factories back, and the lack of high-skilled workers to actually build these plants.
So what is the message of a raid like this? You point out that South Korean companies are spending here. They recently pledged to spend tens of billions of dollars in the U.S. in shipbuilding, semiconductors, batteries, and it's something the U.S. really advocated for. So with a raid like this, what is the message to the business community in South Korea and other foreign companies? Will they keep investing in building in the U.S.?
That's a great question. And I will tell you that the videos and the photos of Koreans being gathered up and treated like criminals is playing all over Asia. And I'm sure today and in the days going forward, boardrooms will be full of discussions about, is the U.S. a reliable trade partner right now? Is this how we want to treat companies that are spending billions of dollars here and creating high-paying, good 21st century jobs for Americans? One of my Korean friends said, it sounds like you want our money, but you don't want us.
What about, you know, the U.S. attorney in Southern Georgia said the operation was to, quote, prevent employers from gaining an unfair advantage by hiring unauthorized workers, unquote. Do you think that's what's going on here?
Well, I think certainly that's part of that, but I think it's a much broader and deeper issue. The U.S. has labor shortages in construction, and we're just not talking about, you know, building a simple house. These are advanced manufacturing facilities, and the question of whether the U.S. has enough high-skilled talent to build these, I think, is a fair question to ask. And I do believe it's very common for you know, when I worked in Korea in the 90s, I would see Americans coming to Korea to oversee the building of their facilities there. As you train and transfer that management technology and that know-how, it takes time and you've got to bring it in. And as you pointed out, shipbuilding, semiconductors, we don't have a lot of that technology in the U.S. We're trying to get it. And the Koreans were willing to do it and bringing their money to do it. And now I'm being asked, is this how you treat your friends?
What about the issue? I mean, one of the things is this plant comes to Georgia and Georgians were hoping this would bring jobs. And now many people are questioning why these jobs were going to foreign workers and not Americans. What do you say to them?
Well, I think, one, I'm, you know, just speaking with the information I've seen from the press, no direct knowledge. But I think it, as I mentioned, when you're building a facility that is a you know, advanced manufacturing in a technology that the U.S. doesn't have, it's, to me, it kind of makes sense that they would send their people to oversee some of the cutting edge stuff that needs to be done. But I think as you know, if you look at the Hyundai and Kia plants, plants that are in Georgia and Alabama, I think you'll find that once the plants are up and running and they, you know, they, the goal is to hire local American citizens. And the reason is because it's cheaper. It's less expensive.
Tammy Overby formerly led the U.S. Korea Business Council at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Tammy, for your time.
My pleasure.
In Florida, jury selection begins today in the trial of the man charged with attempting to assassinate Donald Trump last year when he was running for president.
A Secret Service agent says he spotted Ryan Ruth holding a rifle and fired on the suspect while Trump was golfing at his West Palm Beach club last September. Ruth will represent himself in court. The judge hearing the case granted Ruth's request to dismiss his lawyers.
NPR's Greg Allen will be in the courtroom today. He joins us from Fort Pierce, Florida. So, Greg, why did Ruth decide he wanted to represent himself?
Well, you know, we had a series of pretrial hearings over the last several months, and in the last several, Ruth told Judge Eileen Cannon he was dissatisfied with his attorneys. Because he couldn't hire his own lawyers, he was assigned two federal public defenders. But over the course of several months, he'd said, told the judge he didn't like how they were representing him. In a letter to the judge, he said they were a million miles apart, that's a quote, and were refusing to answer his questions. Judge Eileen Cannon, who's hearing the case, held a couple of hearings and considered an evaluation of Ruth's competency that was done by a forensic psychologist. She agreed Ruth could represent himself, but denied a request from his public defenders that they be released in the trial. Instead, she says they'll serve as standby counsel, helping him with court filings and other legal assistance when needed.
Okay, so remind us, what is Ruth charged with and what penalties could he face?
Right. Well, to recap, in September of last year, a Secret Service agent who was part of Trump's security detail says he saw a gun barrel poking from the tree line a few holes ahead of where the then presidential candidate was golfing. He immediately fired on the person holding the gun. A man later identified as Ruth fled the scene and was arrested a short time later driving north on Interstate 95. The main count he faces is attempted assassination of a major presidential candidate. A conviction on that charge would carry a maximum penalty of life in prison. There are four other counts, including some federal weapons charges, and Ruth has pleaded not guilty to all the charges.
All right, tell us about Ryan Ruth, and tell us about how he'll conduct his defense.
Well, you know, he spent most of his life in North Carolina before moving to Hawaii. He has a criminal record, including a conviction in 2002 for possessing an explosive device. He's apparently held a lot of different political views in his time, supporting people like Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard, and then Donald Trump. He's been a strong supporter of Ukraine. He traveled there and was photographed and interviewed while there. He said he supported Trump for president in 2016 and now regrets that decision. A key piece of evidence in the trial, I think, will be this 12-page letter he left with a friend that was turned over to authorities after his arrest. Prosecutors plan to show just the first page of the letter to the jury. That's where he writes, "Dear world, this is an assassination attempt on Donald Trump, but I failed you." Ruth wants the jury to see the full text of the 12-page letter. He said in a motion to the judge that, quote, "every line is about gentleness, peacefulness, and nonviolent caring for humanity." Judge Cannon says she'll wait until later to rule on that request.
And speaking of Judge Cannon, she had another high-profile case not that long ago. That was Donald Trump's criminal trial on charges that he mishandled classified and top-secret documents.
Right. We heard a lot about Judge Eileen Cannon over the last couple years. She was appointed to the federal bench by Trump in 2020. In that classified documents case, she dismissed the charges against Trump, ruling that the appointment of a special counsel to prosecute the former president was unconstitutional. She was randomly assigned to hear this case.
All right. That's NPR's Greg Allen in Fort Pierce, Florida. Greg, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
PR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics releases some key employment numbers tomorrow for an update on job growth. Overall, the signs point to an economic slowdown, even though unemployment numbers remain at historic lows. You probably remember that President Trump recently fired the BLS commissioner because he didn't like what a recent jobs report showed, that hiring in the U.S. had dropped. The president claimed at that time with zero evidence that the numbers were rigged. So if the president fires people when he doesn't like the data, can the numbers now be trusted? To talk about that, we're joined by former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Leila. Happy to be here.
So on Friday, we had another jobs report come out, the first jobs data since Trump fired the commissioner. And once again, the numbers were not great. They show the labor market is stalling. Do you trust that report?
Yes, I do. The acting commissioner is Bill Wiatrowski, who was deputy commissioner. He's a civil servant, a BLS lifer. In fact, I appointed him to be deputy commissioner, and I'm sure that that number was the same gold standard as always.
The last time we spoke, you were concerned that a move like firing the commissioner over numbers that the president doesn't like would politicize the Bureau, or is an attempt to politicize the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is supposed to be free of politics. But at this point, it sounds like you feel like the public can trust the numbers. That hasn't happened. It hasn't been politicized. Is that right?
That's right. I don't think that the numbers have been politicized at all yet. But of course, I do have fears that they might be in the future. And I will say that I think that the firing of the commissioner was bad for trust in the numbers. And that's because some people will find the administration's attacks credible, and therefore they will lose faith in the trustworthiness of the data, even though it's not any worse. And those who don't find the charges credible may well lose trust because of the changes that they expect the administration to make.
Now, you keep in touch with people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. What's the mood like internally?
I understand that there is a real hit on morale. And this is on top of doing their very best to continue to produce gold standard data, even though staffing is down by 20% and a third of their top leadership positions are vacant.
Wow. Is there any criticism of the Bureau of Labor Statistics that you deem fair? I mean, there have been big revisions to the data, and people have pointed out problems. I mean, before Trump's attacks on the job numbers, for example, that far fewer people actually respond to surveys from the BLS than they did before. So is the data really an accurate picture of what's happening with the economy. I mean, is there anything that does need to change when it comes to data gathering and employment statistics?
Oh, absolutely. Statistical agencies need to be continually modernizing because the economy's changing, technology's changing, the questions that people ask are changing. At the same time that these response rates are falling, we have burgeoning other sources of data. And so that means the agency should be pivoting towards creating new kinds of measures in new ways and collecting data in new ways. And unfortunately, that requires an investment. And instead of being funded to be able to make those modernizations, the funding for the agency has declined by 20% in the last 15 years, and this administration is proposing cutting it by another 8%.
That's Erica Groshen, a former head of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and currently the Senior Economic Advisor at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
My pleasure.
Hundreds of people in dozens of boats have set off from ports around the Mediterranean, the largest civilian attempt to try and break Israel's naval blockade of the Gaza Strip. The effort was organized by climate activist Greta Thunberg and others. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports it's receiving a swell of public support in parts of Europe.
It's a late summer's evening in Rome, and people are enjoying aperitivos in the bars along the Tiber River. On the water, a boat draped in an enormous Palestinian flag sets sail.
I'm on a boat that's making its way down the Tiber through the heart of Rome. Their objective, make as much noise as they can, raise as much awareness as they can for the flotilla that's trying to make its way to break the naval blockade on Gaza.
It gets a good reception. People wave at us from bridges and join in with the chants. In Barcelona and Italy's Genoa, tens of thousands of people marched in a show of solidarity as the first boats in the flotilla to Gaza set sail. An Italian group who put out a call to gather aid to send with the flotilla says they've been overwhelmed, receiving hundreds of tons of food. In cities across Italy, people are holding events they call ground support for the flotilla. There's a common thread in humanity that links us all, Gisella Dragoi says, during a march in Rome. Faced with the images of starvation and suffering of Palestinians in the Israeli offensive against Hamas in Gaza, Dragoi says, people feel desperate and want to help in some way. She says this is a concrete action to get behind. Four Italian lawmakers are joining the flotilla that include people from 44 countries. Past activist flotillas to Gaza have always failed to break the Israeli naval blockade. This one, too, is likely symbolic, but it's the first time an action like this receives support on this scale. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has sounded the alarm about an increase in malicious cyber attacks targeting American water systems.
It's kind of scary that I'm the only door between, you know, the Iranians and our water system. Kind of makes me a little nervous.
How one New England town is defending from digital attacks. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. Taking a look at our weather today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 60s, and tomorrow, slight chance for rain, partly sunny, highs again in the upper 60s. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXC's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sundays, 11 to 4. And the Pine River Bacchus Community Garden celebrates its 15th season with an open house and community meal today, 3:30 to 6, with live music, games for kids, and prize drawings, located just west of the football field at Pine River Bacchus School. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Kutaska Community Action hosts a Big View Conversation tomorrow, 11 to 1, at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. This month, learn more about First Call for Help, whose mission is to provide crisis intervention and referral services. Pre-registration is required. Email alicem@kutaska.org. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5 on Saturday, September 13, 3 o'clock at the Mask and Rose Theater in Petoskey. And the Bell Museum Statewide Star Party is September 18th through the 20th at 24 locations across Minnesota, including the Virginia Public Library Thursday, September 18th at 3:30, and at the Blackwater Environmental Area in Cohasset on the 18th as well. That is at 7 o'clock. It is time now for our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date.
On today's date, September 8th, 1998, I admire the bluebirds sitting on the power lines. Bluebirds are always an exciting bird to see in the springtime. They have a lovely song. They come back to their homes, the nest boxes that we've put out. They check out the boxes. They squabble over who's going to settle where. They won't allow other bluebirds to live right next door, but they'll put up with the tree swallows so they can share these boxes. The bluebirds, once they've hatched their family, sort of disappear from the area. I don't see them very often during the later part of the summer. Oh, here and there, I might spot one or two. But this time of year, the bluebirds begin to congregate on the power lines. If they are a family group, they certainly don't display it on the power lines because they never sit next to one another. There's always, there may be on one may be on an upper line, one may be on a lower line, slightly removed. If they're on the same line, they'll be 5, 10, 15, 20 feet apart. They just keep to themselves, but they still present a beautiful blue and orange backdrop to the colors that are starting to intensify.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From Subaru, the 2025 Subaru Outback features symmetrical all-wheel drive plus standard safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at subaru.com/outback. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Over the weekend, Ukraine says Russia launched its largest airstrikes yet on Ukrainian cities using more than 800 attack drones.
At least five people were killed and dozens were injured. And for the first time, a building in the heavily protected government sector was badly damaged. The attack comes as appeals from the Trump administration have failed to push Russia into ending its war on Ukraine.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis is on the live from Kyiv. Joanna, tell us about this weekend's attacks.
Yeah, actually, I had just gotten back into town when these attacks began on Saturday evening. I woke up in the middle of the night after I heard a very loud and familiar buzzing sound. That's a Shahed drone flying over our neighborhood, and then the booms of air defense trying to shoot down the drones as well as missiles. By early Sunday morning, smoke was billowing from the government sector, which is protected by layers of air defense. The building where President Volodymyr Zelensky's cabinet meets was on fire.
Yeah, and this is a heavily guarded sector of Kyiv. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this the first time a building in that area has been damaged in an attack?
Yes, it's the first time since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Now, according to Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko, the fire appears to have started after burning debris from a destroyed Russian drone fell on the building. And later on Sunday, Yulia Svitenko, she's Ukraine's prime minister, she posted a video to social media of herself walking past the broken walls of the damaged building. Here's a bit of that clip. Now she's saying you can see the consequences of this attack. We've put out the fires, our rescue crews are still working, and it looks like Russia is not seeking peace and is not ready for negotiations. Svitenko went on to say that she hopes Ukraine's allies will respond.
Oh, have they responded?
Well, yeah, they have, at least verbally. Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, said the Kremlin is mocking diplomacy, trampling on international law, and killing indiscriminately, because among those killed in Ukraine was a mother and her infant son in Kyiv. However, the European Union is not entirely united in how to respond to Russian attacks. Hungary and Slovakia, for example, rely on Russian oil and economic ties, and its populist leaders often attack NATO and even the EU leadership as elitists. But von der Leyen said the EU is tightening sanctions on Russia and is helping Ukraine financially and with its military.
Okay, what did President Trump have to say about this?
Well, President Trump told reporters in Washington on Sunday that he is considering new sanctions in response to Russia rebuffing a ceasefire. However, the 50% tariffs the Trump administration imposed on countries like India for buying Russian oil appear to have had no real impact. Speaking to NBC News on Sunday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent suggested that the U.S. is open to partnering with the European Union to impose even more sanctions on countries that buy Russian oil. This would be an attempt to, quote, collapse the Russian economy, as he said, though, of course, that would take quite a while.
So it looks like Russia is able to resist the effects of sanctions. So is Ukraine preparing for an extended war?
Yeah, well, they're preparing by arming themselves. President Zelensky said a couple of days ago that Ukraine now produces more than 60% of its own weapons. And in his evening address last night, Zelensky said Ukraine is fighting what he called air raid anxiety by making air defense a top priority because, according to Ukraine's military intelligence, Russia is producing nearly 3,000 Shahed attack drones every month. And that's a sign that the attacks will continue.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thanks.
You're welcome.
Chinese hackers recently spent nearly a year deep inside a public power utility in Littleton, Massachusetts. U.S. officials said it was part of a large-scale plan to destabilize American infrastructure in the event of a future conflict. Hackers linked to Iran previously breached several U.S. municipal water utilities as well. Now, over 50,000 public water treatment plants across the United States are hoping to stop attacks like that from happening to them. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin sends us this story from Vermont.
It's August in Cavendish, Vermont, and I'm in the thick of things with Chris Hughes.
So where we're going now is the beginning of the process. This is where it comes into the sewer plant.
He's giving me a tour of the wastewater treatment plant, where he's the assistant operator.
There's a manhole right there.
All right.
It's the beginning. That's where it comes off the street, goes into there.
Some days, he's raking through the muck.
What you see there are rags and things that don't belong that we have to screen out ourselves. Some places have automated machines that do that. We don't. We have a rake.
Oh, sounds like a fun job.
Yeah. Yeah, again, either you love it or you don't. It's nature of the beast.
Hughes does love this work in all its technical, mathematical, chemical, and yes, dirty glory. And lately, it's only gotten more complicated. Nowadays, Hughes also has to worry about the threat of cyber attacks.
It's kind of scary that I'm the only door between, you know, the Iranians and our water system. You know, it kind of makes me a little nervous. I don't really have the background to be fending off foreign entities, you know.
The threat is real. To learn more about it, I went to the same man who testified on the subject before Congress last year.
Hi, I'm Robert Lee, CEO of Dragos and co-founder.
Lee used to work in government, including at the NSA. And then he founded Dragos, a company that focuses on protecting the critical industries that keep societies running. He says his company sees hackers burrowing into these systems all the time. Hackers working for nation states like Russia and China, as well as cyber criminals, ransomware groups looking to make money. They understand that water is fundamental, something countries might go to war over, or that companies would pay a steep price to get flowing again.
The reality is that they have a real influence on populations, not only the ability to hurt people, but also scare people.
Lee and Dragos are donating cyber tools to protect utilities like the ones in Cavendish. And they're not the only ones volunteering. There's a new effort underway called Project Franklin, pairing cybersecurity experts with water operators like Hughes. And the Rural Water Association, another teammate on Project Franklin, is getting technical experts into rural water facilities to run threat assessments. During the tour in Cavendish, Hughes walked me through some of the ways these experts have already helped him start securing these systems. Installing network monitoring tools, covering up the Wi-Fi password, saving multiple backups of key data. But more than that, helping him think differently about what could go wrong. We talked about worst-case scenarios as the pumps at the water treatment facility hummed.
If someone got into the system, they could just turn it off and we could stop producing water. We'd be dead in the water, I guess.
Dead in the water. It's serious stuff. Access to water is life and death, but if Hughes could make one final plea with the public, just please don't flush those flushable wipes. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
We'll hear more from the small town of Cavendish, Vermont, and a global threat known as Volt Typhoon this afternoon on All Things Considered. This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report. And at 7:20, it's Events Up North. We'll take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. Our weather today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 60s. And tomorrow, slight chance of rain, partly sunny, highs again in the upper 60s. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. That would be this Thursday, the 11th. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. And the Creative Spirit Fiber Arts Group will hold classes at Willowwood Market just south of Bemidji this Saturday beginning at 10 a.m. Classes include felted bowls, basket making, Zen rock wrapping, and more. Pre-registration is required. Learn more by searching for Willowwood Market on Facebook. And the Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house this Wednesday at 5:30 about the Grand Rapids-La Prairie Corridor Study. Meet at Yanmar Arena for a brief presentation, followed by an opportunity for questions and feedback. The KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout the region from places like Park Rapids to Palo, Talmoon to Reamer, and Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at kaxe.org. Thank you for choosing KAXE this morning. There's more ahead from Morning Edition.
KAXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like, constantly like my friend, like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
For NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. There is another installment in the rivalry at the center of men's tennis. Carlos Alcaraz won the 2025 U.S. Open after beating world number one Jannik Sinner in four sets on Sunday. Alcaraz is now the new top men's tennis player. The matchup between Alcaraz and Sinner was the third Grand Slam final in a row between them. Joining us now is Giri Nathan, staff writer at sports and culture website Defector. He's also the author of a book about the Sinner-Alcaraz rivalry. It's called Changeover, A Young Rivalry and a New Era of Men's Tennis. So what's the key takeaway from yesterday's final, because it looks like Alcaraz could not be beat? He didn't drop a set until he met Sinner yesterday.
Yeah, it was the rare match where these two weren't caught in a true battle. I think Alcaraz very cleanly outplayed Sinner in this one, and especially his serve was really dominant.
Yeah, what makes him so dominant right now? He's 22 years old. It looks like, I mean, he pretty much is unbeatable.
Yeah, these two guys are certainly above the fray, above everyone else, and they have distinct skills. But with Alcaraz, I think he's sort of a hodgepodge of every tennis skill there is. So maybe the best pure athlete on tour with his foot speed and his coordination. And he plays with a ton of creativity. So if I were to contrast the two, I would say Sinner is the epitome of great power and consistency, and Alcaraz is all about unpredictability and creativity because you just never know what shot he's going to hit next.
What about their off-the-court personalities? Are they the type that likes the limelight, that wants to want this rivalry to be something maybe more than it is?
I got a chance to know them a little bit. I think Sinner's more likes to keep his public life and his private life a little more separate. Very cool, chilled-out guy. Alcaraz is for sure more extroverted, and you see him play with the crowd, rile them up. It seems to be a big part of his tennis is the spectacle aspect of it, and he ends up pulling off some pretty incredible shots, I think, for that reason.
Yeah, and he definitely has a personality. I think I heard him say about Sinner that he spent more time with Sinner than his family in the last few weeks.
Yeah, they just keep running into each other at the finals of these huge events. So the past six events that they've entered, they've met in the final in five of them. So they're definitely becoming this sort of duopoly that rules the sport.
So how does this new era in men's tennis compare to the last one? It was kind of a three-headed rivalry. It was Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic. Djokovic is almost probably going to retire soon, but how does this new era maybe compare to that old one?
So the big theme of my book is exploring this generational shift where those three household names, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, were so dominant that they hoarded almost all the major titles in the sport. And it was kind of hard to see the future, what was coming next. So these two players, Sinner and Alcaraz, offer the first real vision of that future. And they were the ones who broke through Djokovic, who was kind of the last gatekeeper from the old guard. And they play with incredible power and spin. I think like Djokovic, they have great flexibility, so they're able to get into these almost side split positions and still hitting really offensive shots. So they're really great movers. They have no weaknesses, great serving and returning. So unlike a lot of players who came before them, there's really no weaknesses to attack.
If they could just pretend to hate each other, that would be great for a fan, right? Giri Nathan is a staff writer at sports and culture website Defector. Giri, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yeah. Check me out. We bounce back like a tennis ball.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Any kind of ball except the football. Bounce back.
back. Bounce back like a tennis ball. Bounce back.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXC provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
The president works to attract more foreign investment after last week's big immigration raid on a foreign-owned construction project in Georgia.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, Avalara can help. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The U.S. government plans to target more businesses for immigration enforcement after a raid on a construction project for a massive car battery plant in Georgia last week led to the arrests of hundreds of South Korean workers. The government in Seoul says a deal has now been reached to fly detained workers home. The factory, adjacent to a new Hyundai electric car factory near Savannah, is a joint operation between Hyundai and LG. The BBC's Gene McKenzie reports from Seoul.
The South Korean government has been working all weekend to get these workers released. Last night, it reached a deal with the US to bring them home on a chartered flight. But the exact details of how and when the workers will be returned still need to be finalized. South Korea's foreign minister is trying to ensure they'll be returned voluntarily rather than deported. The raid at the Hyundai site took place just 2 weeks after South Korea agreed to invest billions of dollars in the U.S. to help it produce the likes of car batteries.
President Trump last night was working to thread the needle of being tough on immigration while at the same time attracting foreign business, posting, quote, "Your investments are welcome and we encourage you to legally bring your very smart people with great technical talent to build world-class products and we will make it quickly and legally possible for you to do so." Markets, the key stock index in Tokyo, went up nearly 1.5% today after Japan's leader Shigeru Ishiba announced he plans to resign. This is a bet that a successor might be more pro-business. Here, S&P futures are up 0.3%. Lottery officials say two people will share the $1.787 billion Powerball jackpot. One bought the ticket in a convenience store in Fredericksburg, Texas. The other somewhere in Missouri is all we know so far. For the businesses that sell tickets, there can also be wins. Marketplace's Javier, well, her name is Carla Javier, reports.
When you go into a convenience store to buy a ticket, the business makes about 5 to 6 cents per dollar and potentially earns your loyalty. Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores.
When somebody is a lottery customer, they tend to buy about 50% more than the non-lottery customer.
Leonard says when the jackpot hits a billion, traffic spikes.
It showcases the store to people who haven't been inside before.
But online lottery retailers are growing. Jackpot.com reports it's doing 5 to 10 times the volume of the last $1 billion prize. Jonathan D. Cohen, who's written extensively about gambling, says spikes in sales are basically a barometer
of people's feeling that they're stuck in their jobs or that they don't have opportunity in the economy or that they're economically insecure.
Cohen says he bought a ticket this time around, and so did Jeff Leonard at a convenience store. I'm Carla Javier from Marketplace.
Economists I've talked to say buying a single lottery ticket may be worth the money in entertainment value, and mathematicians often point out that buying more than one lottery ticket for the same drawing increases your chances of winning by not zero, but close to it.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
It's been about 6 months since the Trump administration started firing federal workers. Some of the first to go may have burned through severance pay if offered, and if they haven't found new work, the end of unemployment benefits looms. Some are turning to food banks and health care for low-income people, Medicaid. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer spent some time with one family.
It's about 9:30 on a sticky morning in downtown D.C., but temperatures are already headed toward the 90s. Amy Uccello is standing near the back of a line stretching to the end of the block, waiting for a chance to get some fresh produce at a food bank.
The first time I was in this line, I was hoping no one would drive by that I would know.
But she's used to it now. Uccello has been coming here every Friday since the end of January, when she was laid off from her job at USAID. Shortly after that, her husband lost his position at a nonprofit working with the agency. All right, the line is moving. Inside, there are carrots, cabbage, greens, and melons. Uccello holds her bag open.
Thank you very much. You can just drop this.
As we head to the car, Uccello sees something fluttering on her windshield.
Oh.
A parking ticket.
$100.
Her eyes fill with tears.
That's going to cut.
Uccello thought she'd be in and out of the food bank before parking restrictions kicked in. She ignored a new, nagging thought. Don't take any chances that could cost money.
It's sort of an ever-present thought on your mind, and it should have been a thought when I parked.
Well, it is what it is, she says. When Uccello gets home, her husband, Christopher Federson, and their year-old daughter are waiting.
Yay!
Up until I got the food. And
after she unpacks the groceries and the baby is fed, Uccello usually turns to the task of job hunting. She figures she sends out about 10 applications a month while taking on as many side hustles as she can manage, including cleaning a friend's Airbnb.
She asked me if I knew anyone who could clean it, and I said, yeah, me.
Behind Uccello's laughter, there's a lot of stress. Her hair is starting to fall out. She finds a bunch in the drain after a shower. She worries about former colleagues. Some have lost their homes. One committed suicide. Job loss is a form of trauma, says Washington State University psychology professor Tahara Probst.
It ranks right up there alongside things like the loss of a loved one, the dissolution of one's marriage, experiencing a major health crisis. It is incredibly stressful.
Adding to the stress, Uccello's expertise is in a field that's rapidly shrinking. Now she's at a crossroads. Does she keep looking for work in her field, change careers, or even go back to what she did before grad school, waiting tables? Holding their baby, her husband, Christopher Federson, talks about a more drastic option.
I think if I'm to do the work that I've been, that my companies have invested skills in me for and that I've become an expert in, that work is probably not in the United States anymore. That probably means going overseas.
They don't have long to ponder their next move. Their unemployment benefits just ran out. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids. 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org. You can click on the donate button, and also there are lots of local news stories and conversations for you to check out. It's kaxe.org. Should be a beautiful day today, mostly sunny with highs in the upper 60s, and for tomorrow, slight chance of rain, otherwise partly sunny and highs in the upper 60s. Coming up 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 7:20, Events Up North, a closer look at the many activities going on throughout the region this week. And you can